Good evening and welcome to the fifth presentation in our fifth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Service at the WKU, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague, Peggy Wright, who with help from Haiwan Wong, the virtual library coordinator, and Brian Carson, our reference coordinator. Our technical specialist tonight is Eric Fisher, recently back from Iraq. Our speaker tonight received his BA in American History from Indiana University Southeast and his MA in Education from Spalding University. He's worked for the Kentucky Derby Museum for 10 years and is involved in all aspects of adult and student programming. He's currently the Outreach Education Coordinator of the Kentucky Derby Museum in Louisville. In this position, he visits over 100 schools and sees more than 34,000 students each year in Kentucky. He's here, he tells me, he'll be visiting Warren East tomorrow. He teaches them about the thoroughbred industry and about that very special race which takes place the first Saturday each May. Since nothing is more intimately associated with Kentucky than the Derby, it's our very great pleasure to welcome Ronnie Drostad to talk about it.
Good evening, everyone.
Evening.
I want to welcome you all to the bookstore. Once again, my name is Ronnie. I'm from the Kentucky Derby Museum in Louisville. I do want to ask, has anybody ever been to the Derby Museum that's here?
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I certainly want to welcome you back if you're ever in the Louisville area. And guys, I got to tell you, it's only 58 days away. 58 days from today will be the first Saturday in the month of May. And with the snows coming tomorrow and all that's coming, I'm just looking forward to that 75-degree day that's going to happen. So let me go into a little bit of the background of how the Derby got started. But really what I want my emphasis to be tonight are the stories. You know, the Kentucky Derby is the longest running continuous sporting event in the United States. They've never missed a year since they first started back in 1875. And what I think makes the Derby so great, of course, it's the traditions, it's the hats, it's the parties, and if you like mint juleps, it's the mint juleps. But really what makes the Derby special, I think, are the people and the horses, the stories. And we have a lot of chapters to choose from, but I just wanted to choose a couple that are special to me, and maybe some of them that aren't what you would normally think about the Derby. So let's go to Churchill Downs for a moment. I've got a good picture of what the Derby's all about right here. And of course, at Churchill Downs, first of all, it's famous for its twin spires. And the two big twin spires were built in 1895, about 20 years after the first Derby. The original grandstand was on the other side of the track of where it's located now, which was a terrible, terrible idea. Because, number one, late in the afternoon, you were looking right into the sun in the west. And also, you were sitting downwind of the horse barns. And a lot of people didn't like that. So finally, in 1895, they built a new grandstand, which is what this middle section would have been. And you can see underneath the famous spires, the people in the crowd yelling and screaming. And last year, guys, a beautiful sunny day, we had our third largest crowd ever. Almost 158,000 people came to the racetrack, including a very, very special guest. Queen Elizabeth, yeah, the Queen had always wanted to come to the Derby, and she was the guest of Will Farish, who's the former ambassador to Great Britain, and he has horses here at Churchill Downs, so there's your connection. There's 12 races that day, but the main event goes off at 6:04 p.m., 5:04 p.m. if you live in Bowling Green, and here they come. And what I tell the kids when I'm talking to them is what you see right here, guys, the biggest, fastest, strongest three-year-old thoroughbreds in the world. And, of course, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get to the finish line first. Of course, last year, his name was Street Sense. And it didn't look like Street Sense had any chance at all winning that race. Early on, when the starting gates opened, he popped out of there in 19th place. And all the way around that racetrack, he stayed in 19th place. And finally, they went around that last turn, and his jockey, Calvin Burrell, longtime journeyman jockey who had never really had a good Derby contender before, saw his chance. He asked Street Sense to go, and I've never seen this before, guys. Going around that last turn, he passed 17 horses. He hit the top of the straightaway. There was only one more horse to pass. His name was Hard Spun, and Hard Spun's from a town not too far from here, Madisonville, Kentucky. But Hard Spun, he looked back, he saw Street Sense coming, and he dug in as hard as he could, but he was no match for Street Sense. About halfway down the straightaway, Street Sense took the lead, and when he got to the finish line, he was all by himself. And he won the Derby by 2.5 lengths. And guys, when Straight Sense won the Derby last year, he became our 133rd Derby champion. The kind of interesting thing about it, though, is when he did cross that finish line, he was on his way to the winner's circle. And guys, we've had 133 different horses visit this winner's circle, and when Street Sense won the Derby, he was the 100th horse from Kentucky to win the race. And originally, I'm from Indiana, and so I hate to admit this part, but Indiana's never had one. Tennessee, just to the south here, they've had three horses win the Derby. And Ohio, one state up to the north, they've had one, but 100 of them were born in Kentucky. And that shows you right there, guys, the fastest thoroughbreds in the world, they're born and raised right here in the state of Kentucky. And so it's a great moment up there, a lot of great history, a lot of great tradition. You know, the governor's up there, the track president, and they call it the Run for the Roses. 554 roses on the garland, and of course it's made by Kroger now. You can go to Kroger's and make them watch it. Okay, I think we'll get into our PowerPoint a little bit and introduce some of the people that really have made the Derby kind of what it is today. And the name of the program that I have here is called Derby Legends and Other Truths. And, of course, at the racetrack, truths is in quotation marks there. The first person we want to meet is this guy here. In 1875, when they ran the first Derby, it really was more kind of a regional event. It wasn't drawing horses from the East Coast at this point or anywhere else. And this guy here, he wasn't supposed to win. His name's Aristides. And all this horse was supposed to do was set a fast pace. And his more talented stablemate, whose name was Chesapeake, was then supposed to come from behind and pick up the pieces. Well, Aristides did what he was told. He got out there and set a really, really fast pace. Very fast pace. But then as the jockey, Oliver Lewis, looked back at the top of the stretch to find his stablemate, Chesapeake was way, way back there. And the owner of this guy, the legend has it, he was at the top of the stretch and he had a red flag and he was yelling, "Just keep going, just keep going." And he did keep going. And Aristides, when he crossed the finish line, a lot of people don't realize that it kind of shows you the talent of the horse, what they were getting even for that first Derby. He set the track, or the not the track record since it was the first Derby, but he set the United States record for a mile and a half. That kind of shows you right there, the Derby was getting very, very good horses at that point. Aristides was owned by this gentleman that's coming up here. His name was H.P. McGrath. And H.P. McGrath really didn't fit in with the society of that time. He, this was starting to get into the Victorian era. Very proper, a lot of manners. That didn't suit him at all. He liked to drink. He liked to cuss. He liked to throw big parties at McGrathiana, which was a huge mansion right outside of Lexington, Kentucky. And had quite a temper also. And so he didn't quite fit in. And that kind of shows you the kind of people they were drawing at Churchill Downs from the early years. It kind of had that Wild West mentality early on. And as a result, a lot of the people with money weren't going to the racetrack. Another person who was kind of interesting was this gentleman here. His name was Ed Corrigan. And Mr. Corrigan ended up having several Derby winners to his name. But he was—he really symbolized the wild West mentality. And one of my favorite stories was one early morning, he was watching his Derby contender working out on the racetrack. And he was standing up the rail, had a cup of coffee, and his horse was out there. But another horse next to him was kind of acting up and kind of rearing up a little bit. And he didn't want his horse getting hurt, so he yelled at the exercise rider to, "Hey, get your horse away from my horse." Probably not in that kind of language, but you can kind of get the idea. Well, the kid up on the horse looked down back at Corrigan and basically told him where to go. And you didn't tell him that. He ended up, this guy was 60-some years old at this point. He jumps the fence, gets onto the racetrack, pulls the kid off the horse, throws him down, and before they could pull him off the kid, he got several good licks in. Well, the kid got up and swore revenge on him later on in the day when the races were going on. And the rest of the day, he was kind of watching around, seeing what was going on, and sure enough, he saw a kid kind of tailing him a little bit. And he wasn't wasting any time. He grabbed the kid again, threw him down, and then hollered for a police officer to come and help him out. And they did. They frisked. No gun or anything. Well, that didn't suit him. He didn't think the police officer did good, so he attacked the police officer. So you're scoring at home. That's three fights right there. And that kind of shows you what was going on at the racetrack back in the 1880s. It was a rough place to go. And as a result, a lot of people with money wouldn't go. And by the 1890s, guys, the Derby was really struggling. In 1892, only three horses were entered into the race. And by 1894, Churchill Downs went bankrupt. They just ran out of money. They couldn't get people there. It looked like the Derby was completely finished in 1894. Luckily, a new group of people bought the property, and they made a lot of changes to the place. They built the big twin spires. They built a new grandstand. They shortened the Derby down to a mile and a quarter, what it is today. And slowly but surely, it started to show a profit again. And it was a guy named Matt Wynn, who they hired to be their first general manager. He's the one who got all of these traditions going, and he's the one that really kind of made the Derby what it is today. Matt Wynn. I think another thing that makes the Derby what it is today. There's another. There's one of our first celebrities. I should have mentioned him. Anybody know who that is? Older brother of Jesse James. Yeah, Frank James. He's another one that kind of scared people away from the racetrack too. He was really our first big celebrity to come to the Derby, and the year was 1889, and it caused quite a stir when he showed up right there. And it's kind of an interesting Derby. He had bet on a horse named Spokane. And he was against the big horse named Proctor Knot. And Proctor Knot looked like he was going to win, but when he went around that turn, he blew the turn and veered way to the outside, which gave Spokane, hugging the rail, a chance to catch up. And when they hit the finish line, they had no idea who won. No photo finishes back in those days. The judges all huddled up, argued a few minutes about who won the Derby, and they finally gave it to Spokane. Of course, he had bet $5,000 on Spokane, too, so... There's another kind of a Wild West attitude going on there. Okay, we'll leave Frank James behind. He left 50,000 wealthier that day. There's Kingman right there. Kingman still has a track record. And this is kind of showing you the struggles of the 1890s. Anybody know his track record? No? Kingman, 1891, still has the record for the slowest Derby ever run. In fact, that race was so slow... The newspaper the next day wouldn't even call it a horse race. They called it a funeral procession. And the damage was certainly done. It took that poor horse almost 3 minutes to win the race that year. And what happened was, it wasn't his fault. He was ridden by a great African-American jockey named Isaac Murphy. And Ike Murphy had some very specific instructions before the race. The trainer went up to him before the race and said, "Whatever you do, when those horses leave that gate, don't take the lead. Let somebody else get the lead, set the pace, you come up and pass them at the end." Problem was, every trainer had the same instructions. So they went around, no one would take the lead, they kept pulling back on their horses, and finally they got around and the damage had already been done. They all hit the top of the stretch, they all took off at the same time, but like I said, it took almost 3 minutes to win the race that year. Well guys, the Derby really turned around. I mentioned in 1894, the new group of people bought the property and made a lot of changes. 1915 was the first girl to come out and beat the boys. That got people's attention. But really it was the Triple Crown, I think, and those horses that really kind of captured the imagination, because then it took the Derby more than just the first Saturday of May. It, you know, 2 weeks after you win the Derby, you have to go to Baltimore, Maryland, and you have to win another completely different race, the Preakness Stakes. And then after you win the Preakness Stakes in Baltimore, Maryland, you have to hop on another airplane or train or however you're going to travel. And you have to go up to New York and win the big, grueling mile-and-a-half Belmont Stakes in New York City. Only 11 horses have ever been able to do this. And we haven't had one since 1978. Affirmed was our last horse to win the Triple Crown in 1978. So it's been a long time. So what I thought we'd do for a few minutes is meet those 11 horses that were able to do it. And the first one never gets any credit at all. It's this guy right here. And the reason why he never got any credit is because back in 1919 when he won it, there was no such thing as a Triple Crown. They didn't start calling it the Triple until the 1930s. This guy here, his name is Sir Barton. And Sir Barton was downright evil. And those aren't my words, those were his owner's words. And there was really only one thing that Sir Barton liked to do more than run, and that's bite people. And he was absolutely irascible. Even before the Derby, they checked the horses out a little bit, and the veterinarian was checking him out. They got around his legs, and he went down and took a bite out of his shoulder. So he was a really, really, really tough horse. He did win the Triple Crown the hard way, because in 1919, after he won the Derby, the Preakness was only 4 days later. They put that horse on a train right away, got him to Baltimore, and he won it. Then he won another race between that and the Belmont. So I guess he was a quadruple crown winner there. Mostly, though, he was kind of known, unfortunately, at the same time, there was another horse racing on the East Coast that was much more popular. You might know who that would have been? Man of War. Yeah, Man of War, War Admiral's dad there. Man of War was tearing it up on the East Coast. He was tearing it up kind of in the Western circuits, what they called this. And they finally met in 1921, I think it was, in a match race where it was just the two of them. And there was a lot of build up to it, a lot of hype, but it turned out not to be much to it. In fact, his jockey was a guy named Earl Sandy. And Earl Sandy, 4 minutes before he went down to get on his horse, the trainer went and pulled him off of him. Said, "Nah, you're not riding horse. I want to get somebody more experienced." Sandy was livid and went back to the corner, and they said he couldn't even move. He was so mad. We'll hear from Earl Sandy here again in a second, though. Sir Barton went out, got crushed by Man of War. Man of War ended up winning 20 out of 21 races for his career. He was born in Kentucky. He died in Kentucky. Never raced in Kentucky. Man of War's owner, Sam Riddle, couldn't stand our track president at Churchill Downs, Matt Wynn, so he wouldn't bring his horse out to run. Just as a side note, anybody know the only horse to ever beat Man of War?
Upset.
Yeah, his name was Upset. So he had to win that, right? So the only time he ever lost a race.
Big Upset.
Well, this is our second Triple Crown winner. His name's Gallant Fox. And Gallant Fox was one of those baby horses that nobody could get a handle on. They couldn't handle him. Finally, his trainer decided, "Well, I'm going to find me a jockey who knows what he's doing." So he called up Earl Sandy. Earl, it's kind of funny how that all kind of, what comes around goes around. Sandy had been retired for a couple years and was trying to train horses, but that wasn't really doing very good. So he said, "Yeah, I'll ride the horse right there." And it was just a magical thing that happened. When he started riding Gallant Fox, he went on a big long winning streak, and he became our second Triple Crown winner. And that's when it became known as the Triple Crown, when Gallant Fox won it.
1930,
right. Just five years later was the next Triple Crown winner. And what kind of makes this Triple Crown winner? There's Earl Sandy right there, who was riding Gallant Fox. This Triple Crown winner, his name is Omaha, 1935. And what? This will never happen again, ever. He was the son of Gallant Fox. So we have father-son Triple Crown winners. And you'll probably never see that again. He was the first Triple Crown winner and only Triple Crown winner to ever race in Europe. Soon after he won the Triple Crown, they put him on a boat. They were going to run him in England. And he really gave him a scare, because when he got over to to England, his handler wasn't paying attention and let go of him on the docks, and the horse got loose. And he's running up and down the docks of England loose. And finally, what got him? You might know what got him? Big handful of sugar. Gets him every time. And that got him back up there. You see, real long, lean horse right there, too. Very long, probably well over 16 hands tall, that horse right there. You only had to wait 2 more years till you got another Triple Crown. And he's really more one of the well-known Triple Crown winners. Really, really tiny little guy. You can see next to his handler right there, not a very big horse. And his name is War Admiral. And War Admiral, unfortunately, he only lost 5 races in his whole life. But one of them was to a horse named Bestseller in here, Seabiscuit. And Seabiscuit was just a star. And it was a match race, and they met in Baltimore, Maryland, Seabiscuit versus the big Triple Crown winner there. And, of course, Seabiscuit beat him. And it's kind of unfortunate for him. I mean, you only lose 5 races in your whole life, and now when you tell kids about War Admiral, "Oh, he's a horse that lost." Yeah. Okay. A couple years later, after War Admiral, a small little giant there, after he won the Triple Crown, this is one of my favorite ones right here, and this is Whirlaway. Whirlaway was from Calumet Farms, and we have teachers in here, don't we? Any teachers? I know you're around kids a lot in the museum you work at, but Whirlaway was one of those little horses that just drove his trainer crazy because he was brilliant. I mean, physically, the horse was just absolutely brilliant. Incredible turn of foot, incredible speed. His problem was his attitude, okay? He was just one of those horses that didn't really ever want to do what he was told, and his trainer said he was more nervous than a cat in a room full of rocking chairs, okay? And he had a really, really bad habit of when he would go around a turn heading for home, he thought that the inside rail was going to jump out and get it. And he'd bolt. He'd bolt to the far outside, and he was so brilliant, he'd still win a lot of these races. But his trainer knew that wasn't going to work in the Derby. So what he did is he put blinkers on it. Blinkers is a mask that you can see right there on the horse that covers their eyes, because horses can see just about all the way around them without turning their heads. And so they get distracted easily. So you put the blinkers on, it helps keep them focused straight ahead. Well, it didn't help him at all. All it did was confuse him. Okay, put the blinkers on him, and it just made it worse. So finally, a couple days before the Derby, his trainer, Ben Jones, got out a pocket knife, and Eddie Arcaro, the jockey, said, "What are you going to do to this horse?" You know, and he was going at him with this knife, and he says, "I know what I'm doing." And he took the blinkers, and he cut one of them off. Well, Arcaro, the jockey, said, "You know, it's a little late to be experimenting now. The Derby's just a couple days away here." But it worked, guys, and what it did is it blocked him from seeing that inside rail. But he could still see the outside, which would give the horse perspective where he was on the racetrack. And not only did he win, but he set the track record that day. And he went on to win the Preakness and the Belmont, and Whirlaway, considered one of the all-time greats. Sometimes it just takes those of you with kids know, it just takes a small adjustment sometimes to bring the best out of them. Okay, after Whirlaway, that unmanageable horse from 1941, just 2 years later, you have a very underrated horse. Most people forget about this guy here as far as the great ones, but people who saw him don't forget him, and his name was Count Fleet. Count Fleet, when he retired, had the same record as Secretariat. He won 16 out of 21, but when he got to the Belmont, he absolutely crushed the Belmont. He won the Belmont by 25 lengths. But what I like to remember about this guy, notice it's in color. He's the oldest winning Derby winner ever, and he lived to be the ripe old age of 33 years old. Most of them make it to about 20 to 25. And what I love about him is they had him on a breeding farm, and he was well past the years of breeding, but he would still, when they'd unload the fillies off the truck, he was nickering the whole time. So that's Count Fleet there, the 1943 Triple Crown winner. 43. And that takes us to a horse that they ought to make a movie about this guy here, 1946. And notice we've had a lot of Triple Crown winners in the 30s and 40s. This really was the golden era of horse racing. And this guy here, he did it the hard way, because when he was a baby down in Texas, down at King Ranch, he stepped on a surveyor's stake, and that surveyor's stake went all the way through his hoof. Until the day he died, he walked with a limp. In fact, they called him the Clubfoot Comet. And his name was Assault. And he was fine when he ran. There was no trouble when he ran, but when he walked, to the day he died, he walked with a limp. Probably just a habit after a while. So that's 1946 from King Ranch, Assault, the Clubfoot Comet. And then there was a long break. Not a very long break at all. 2 years. 2 years to the next Triple Crown winner, and many would consider this guy to be the greatest ever. He has before you leave, check out this gentleman's walking stick right here. You can see it's kind of a custom-made, and it says Citation on there. Well, there's Citation right there. Not a physically imposing horse at all. Stood about 15 and a half hands tall. And he was definitely the greatest one from Calumet Farm. Calumet ended up having 9 Derby winners. But most people would say he was their greatest. And he was never flashy. He would never beat anybody bad. He would just get to the finish line first. The first 2 years of his racing career, he ran 29 times. He won 27 of them. And he was the first $1 million winner, the first horse to ever earn over $1 million. And that's Eddie Arcaro on his back. He was out of Cincinnati. He won the Derby 5 times and was the only jockey to ever win 2 Triple Crowns. He always said that Citation there was his greatest horse. He said when you got on Citation, it was just like driving a Cadillac. You know, just as smooth as can be. Well, after Citation, we had a big long streak without any Triple Crowns. We had a great horse show up in 1953. Some people would consider him the greatest horse to never win the Triple Crown, owned by the Vanderbilts. You know, the Vanderbilts showed up at Churchill Downs in 53. It caused a stir, and they brought this horse named Native Dancer. Now, that's when television was getting big, too, and Native Dancer was easy to spot because he was gray. All the other horses back in those days were brown, and everybody loved watching Native Dancer at home because he'd fall way behind. And then when his jockey, Eric Guerin, would ask him, boy, he'd come flying. And when you're watching that on a black and white TV, it looked like a white ghost going across the screen. And the highest rated Derby ever was the 1953. And I don't know if I should believe this or not, but I've read it somewhere. 72% of households that had a TV were tuned into the Derby. They wanted to watch a native dancer. He was 9 for 9 going into the race. He fell way behind like he always did. And then, boy, when they come around that turn, boy, the jockey asked him to run it. He went flying across that screen. Crowd's going crazy. The only trouble was, guys, there was one horse in there that wasn't going to let him by.
Dark Star.
Dark Star, right, from Oldham County. And Dark Star never won much after that, but on the first Saturday of May in 1953, he wouldn't let Native Dancer by. He lost by that much. After that race, Native Dancer never lost again. He won 21 out of 22, his only loss, the 53 Derby. So I always tell the kids, too, you get one shot at the Derby. You know, it happens when you're 3 years old. And so that's it. Okay, let's meet another Triple Crown winner. And by the time they got to the next Triple Crown winner, it was certainly worth the wait. It was this gentleman right here. Probably, some would say, the greatest racehorse ever. Anybody know who that is?
Secretariat.
Yeah, Big Red. Secretariat right there. And Walt Disney's making a movie about him right now. I'm kind of nervous because, you know, I don't want him to get too, you know, embellishment with it. But if they do it right, it's going to be an amazing story, because what he did to horse racing in the 70s was just phenomenal. He got to Louisville in 1973 off of a loss. He lost the Wood Memorial the race before in New York City, and a lot of people were thinking, ah, he's one of those bold ruler horses. He can't run a mile and a quarter. Well, what he did in the Derby, guys, will probably never happen again, because he broke out of the starting gate slow. But if any of you guys have ever run in a long-distance race before, you know, even if you win, you're going to get tired. That horse right there ran every eighth of a mile faster than the one before it. As the race got longer, the horse got stronger, and when he crossed the finish line, they call it the greatest 2 minutes in sports, 1:59.25. Still the record to this day. A lot of people don't know the horse right behind him ran the second fastest Derby too. His name was Sham, and he clocked in 1:59.4, and he picked the wrong year to be 3 years old. 2 weeks later, after he won that Derby, he went to Baltimore, Maryland for the Preakness and was just as phenomenal. Ran reverse fractions where he ran every eighth faster. And after that, guys, he was a star. He made the cover of Time Magazine, Sports Illustrated, and Newsweek all in the same week. Time Magazine dressed him up like Superman. They put a cape on him and everything. And so people were saying, okay, we haven't had a Triple Crown winner since 1948 Citation. Is this the chosen one or not? And he goes to New York as a celebrity, and he saved the best for last. And when you get home, here's a homework assignment. If you have internet access, pull up YouTube, hit the 1973 Belmont, and you'll never forget it. Because what he did, guys, halfway around that racetrack is he took the lead. Except instead of the horses coming to get him, the lead kept getting bigger and bigger. And when he turned around the turn heading for home, he was ahead by about 15 lengths. The crowd's going crazy. Well, the horse kept going. And usually when a horse sets a track record, it's because other horses are pushing him. Guys, when he crossed the finish line, the second place horse was 31 lengths behind him. You line up 31 horses in a row, that's how much he won the race by. He shattered the world record for a mile and a half by almost 2 seconds. Horse racing, that's a long time. So he didn't set the track record that day, he set the world record. So he definitely won the Belmont in style. They did. Here's a picture of that race. Just a black and white shot of it, and you can see his jockey right there, Ron Turcotte, a former lumberjack out of Canada, wonder what's going on. He's looking back right there, and I love the guy using the whip right there. It's like, come on, we're going to catch him. No, I don't think so. So that's Secretariat crossing the finish line, and of course those people in the crowd right there, they witnessed one of the greatest moments in sports right there. And like I said, pull it up on YouTube. It's on there, and you'll be amazed. They did find out he had a secret. Not only was Secretariat bigger than everybody else and stronger than everybody else and better looking than everybody else, he died in 1989, Claiborne Farm in Kentucky. They found out he did have a little secret. A normal heart inside of a horse weighs 7 pounds. They did a necropsy on him. He had a heart that weighed 21 pounds. 3 times larger than a normal heart. And it happens sometimes in sports where you'll have just a genetic fluke. Lance Armstrong, he's a great cyclist, and one thing that helps him is he stands about 5'11", but his heart's the size of a guy who stands 6'6". So sometimes strange things can happen in nature, and it can do wonders. Well, after Secretariat won the Triple Crown, it was only a couple years later where we had another Triple Crown winner, and this was Seattle SLU. Now, a lot of people say Seattle SLU was the best, but I don't know. He certainly was a bargain. The people who bought him were from Seattle, Washington. They paid, I think, $17,000 for him. By the time they sold him to Three Chimneys Stud, and when he died just a few years back, he had earned something like $440 million in the breeding shed. So he was quite an animal. He's the only Triple Crown winner I've ever met in person, and I'm very proud to this day to have been bitten by Seattle SLU. And, I don't know if the mark's still there or not, but I turned around, was going to have my picture taken with SLU, and boy, he reached out and just took a bite on my shoulder. So I'm very proud of that, actually. He was kind of ornery. The last horse to pull off the Triple Crown was a horse named Affirmed. A lot of people forget about Affirmed, and it's kind of unfortunate because, boy, he really did it the hard way. You know, some of these Triple Crown winners, the competition wasn't quite up to par. But you can't talk about Affirm without talking about Ali Dar. And it's really one of the great all-time great rivalries in sports. And Ali Dar was one of those horses that liked to kind of fall way behind and then make a mad charge at the end. And Affirm was the opposite. His personality was, when he left that gate, he was going to dare other horses to try to pass him. And didn't work too good in the Derby. Ali Dar fell way too far back and made a big charge. But he was still about two or three lengths behind Affirmed at the finish line. So the jockey in the Preakness says, well, I'm going to lay a little closer, and I'm going to come and get him this time. And actually, in the Preakness, Ali Dar was the favorite. Okay? Well, Affirmed saw him coming, and he held him off again. But Ali Dar got this close this time. And they crossed the finish line. So 3 weeks later in the Belmont, Affirmed is still getting no respect, and Ali Dar goes off as the favorite again. And boy, this time he laid real close. He was real close the whole race. And boy, they turned around home, and that jockey asked Ali Dar to run, and he exploded with speed. And about halfway down that stretch, those two hooked up side by side. But then Affirmed dug in and wouldn't let him by. Ali Dar actually did get his nostril in front for a few strides, but when they crossed the finish line, Affirmed had battled back, and he won the Belmont by that much. One of the closest finishes ever. And I think it just shows you know, the competitive nature of these animals. They don't want to lose. And to highlight that, and then I'll wrap it up here in a few minutes, guys, the great horse Cigar. You might remember Cigar from about 10, 15 years ago. He was bred to run on grass. Both of his parents preferred running on grass, but he ran 11 times on grass tracks and he only won one race. So his trainer, Bill Mott, said, well, let's try the dirt. He won 16 in a row once he got on the dirt, and he's still the all-time leading money earner ever. He earned about $10 million on the track. Going for number 17 in a row, going for Citation's record. He was out in California. Cigar took the lead going around the turn, was heading towards the finish line, but coming down the straightaway was a horse named Darren Go. Darren Go passed him and won the race. On the way back to the barn, Bill Mott, Cigar's trainer, said, you know, after every race, I give this horse a peppermint. And, you know, you've earned about $10 million. I'm going to go ahead and give you a peppermint here. The horse wouldn't touch it. The horse, you know, his ears were pinned back, just didn't look, it wouldn't touch the peppermint. And guys, that just kind of shows you there. You know, these horses know when they get on that track, it's a herd mentality. I want to be the leader of the pack. And Affirm there, he was one of the toughest leaders of the pack ever. Well, that's our last one, guys. That's our last Triple Crown. It's been a long time since we've had one. Of course, Smarty Jones a couple years gave us a thrill. We thought he might be able to do it real quiet. Came this close to winning the Triple Crown back in 1998. Of course, a lot of people say, you know, what if Barbro could have just stayed healthy and not hurt himself? Could he have pulled it off? But we'll have to wait another year or two, or hopefully maybe this year we'll have a Triple Crown. But we've had a lot of other great horses, too, guys. This one's one of my favorites. You know who this is?
Man of War.
Nope, close. He's related to Man of War.
What?
1958. This horse right here is probably the most popular horse ever to come to Churchill Downs. Let me tell you about him. You can see he made the cover of Sports Illustrated. And why he made the cover of Sports Illustrated? In small print it says, "Can the hobo beat the giant?" It's because his parents were mules. Not really, but basically, you know, the breeding industry is so powerful and everything, and you know, you think about bloodlines. Well, his parents didn't do anything, and he came out of nowhere, and he was out in California, and what he liked to do, his running style, he didn't fall way back, he fell several states back. In fact, guys, in a 6-furlong race, which is a sprint, this horse fell 32, 35 lengths behind, then decided it was time to start running. And made a mad dash in a 6-furlong race and won the race. Amazing. A couple weeks later, they run him in the Santa Anita Derby, a big Derby prep race. He does the same thing and wins the race. Well, his owner, this guy's last name was Ross, said, "You're banned from the track," because he had a heart condition. His doctors wouldn't let him attend the races. And so he's taking this horse to Kentucky. And everybody thinks it's just kind of a fluke thing that's going on. And he's taken on Tim Tam, who was from Calumet Farm, and he was the giant in the picture there. And when he got to Louisville, though, it was crazy. He got on the train, they unloaded him, and there were school kids waiting for him. And his owners would let him come up, and they'd put kids on his back. And he's real friendly, laid-back horse. You could pet him. And they were selling silky hats and silky T-shirts and silky special drinks the taverns were making and all this stuff. It was like silky mania going everywhere. And CBS had the coverage that year. They even had the silky cam because they knew he'd fall way back, so they had a split screen. They had the Derby on one side, and Silky had his own camera on the other. Well, sure enough, he falls 35 lengths behind, like he always does. The crowd's waiting. You know, they can't wait to see him come at him. And they go around that last turn, his jockey says, and he explodes with speed, passes two horses, and finishes third to last. And that's why you've never heard of Silky Sullivan right there. No one cares about it. But he's probably the most famous horse, just, you know, that 15 minutes of fame. He's the most famous horse we've ever had in Louisville there. Well, after Silky, you know, everybody loves a long shot. And this guy here was the longest shot of them all right here. And we'll wrap up our stories today with this guy. His name was Donerail. He showed up in 1913. Nobody thought he had a chance, but you can see him in the winner's circle right there. He won the race. He went off at 91-1. 91-1. And why is his owner so sad? He didn't bet on him. Exactly. He didn't bet on his own horse. So just the moral of the story, if any of y'all have horses, if you get one to the Derby, put $2 on him, you know. And because, you know, yeah, that's Roscoe Goose. And he grew up just down the street from the racetrack. And a lot of people think that's why that horse was even entered into the race, because the jockey there, you know, he wanted to win, you know, in front of the hometown folks and maybe talked. Roscoe Goose there, he became a great, very wealthy man from saving up his money and become a racing official. His niece works at the Derby Museum, where we're still in the family there. So that's Donerail there, 91-1, the longest shot to ever win. And of course, you'll have your long shots from time to time. There's Giacomo. He went off three years ago, and he's the third longest shot to ever win. So 58 days from today, we're going to do it again. We'll do it again 58 days from today, guys, and we'll add another chapter to our Derby story. It'll be our 134th chapter. I love talking about the past. Don't know anything about the future, unfortunately. So I will throw out a couple names, though. If you like Court Vision, Bill Mott, the all-time leading trainer at Churchill Downs. Never has won the big one, though. So he's got a horse named Court Vision. If you like horses that come from out of it, a horse named Pyro. Looking pretty good. Guys, I want to thank y'all for coming out today. Does anyone have any questions about horses or the Derby? I'd be glad to take questions.
In England, they call it a Derby.
Yeah.
And why do we call it a Derby? Since, you know, this part of the country was settled mostly by English and Scots.
Our tongues are just a little lazier. Okay. That's it.
We run counterclockwise. Mm-hmm. They run clockwise.
Yes.
Why did that start?
That is actually kind of interesting. The reason why we go counterclockwise is during the American Revolution, that's one of the ways we rebelled. We said if King George is running his horses that way, we're going the other way. And for a long time, I thought that was just a legend. But the research I've done on it is true. And that's one of the ways we rebel.
What kind of things do you collect? And having ever been to the Derby Museum, what kind of...
The Derby Museum, really, I mean, when you go down the archives, it's amazing. We're redoing the archives right now. In fact, they got a grant to do that. And all kinds of stuff, from hats to old games and beer bottles and pop culture items, things like that. You know, and of course, we have lots of saddles, different pieces of equipment. We're working on right now, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I will. We're, you know, Bill Shoemaker, the great jockey. He won the Derby 4 times. Should have been 5, a legend I should have put on her. He misjudged the finish line 1 year. Stood up on this horse at the 16th pole, and then he realized, whoops, and too late. But he won the Derby 4 times, and he died a couple years back, and we're trying to get his collection. which would just be extensive. Another thing we're working on right now and we're hoping to put on display in a couple of years is a Gold Cup exhibit. And we have a curator at the museum who's working on tracking down these Gold Cups. And it's amazing where they end up. You know, sometimes they're pawned off and everything. But just a quite an extensive collection. My favorite piece in the museum, though, is actually a video screen. And we call it the Time Machine. And we've got derbies all the way back to 1918. Most of those back in those days were newsreels. And you can watch any derby back to 1918 on the video screen. It's all in high definition now, too, so it's real clear, real neat.
What's the oldest derby program, y'all?
We've got one from the first one in 1875. We do have a derby program from 1875. Yeah.
Well, 1915, Regret first fell in one derby.
That's
so
right.
On eBay for $7,500.
$7,500, 1915? Man, excellent.
Before the Churchill Downs, I think that the race, or maybe two races prior to that, was down at the Bill Mead Plantation in Nashville.
Right. Yeah, they were very famous, 19th century.
So they moved it to Churchill.
Yeah, and one of my favorite stories down in Tennessee, you know, back in the before the Derby, you know, the horse racing had gone a long time before the Derby was ever thought of, and most of the jockeys back in those days were African American, and back in the slave days, if you had a slave who was really a really good horse person, that's who you'd stick on the back of that horse, and boy, Andrew Jackson was involved in several very high stakes races down in Tennessee. And by the way, Andrew Jackson was the first president and only president to ever have a racing stable out of the White House. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned the rose blanket has 554 roses. Yeah. What's the tradition behind that?
There really isn't one. It's just tradition now. And back in the days, when they would put it all together, they used the prime rose off of each bush. And over time, that number 554 just became associated with it. There's no real reason behind it. That's just what they do now. Everything for the Derby now is tradition now.
All red or mixed color?
All red. Yep, all red.
John Henry never won the Kentucky Derby, Preakness, or the Belmont.
No. No, John Henry was one of those horses when he was young. Wasn't any good. Seabiscuit was like that too. When he was young, sometimes it's a physical thing where they just haven't matured physically enough. A lot of times it's mental, and they just have to mature mentally. But John Henry was absolutely vicious. A lady who volunteers at our museum used to own John Henry, and they just wanted to get rid of him. And they did get rid of him. They sold him for about $3,000 or $4,000, and he goes off and earns $3-4 million. But yeah, he was incorrigible as a youngster. Turned out to be a great one.
I enjoyed reading the article that the lady took care of him at the horse park.
Right.
Said there was a game between she and him as to get him into the stable.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very intelligent animal, so he liked to really play the game
yeah,
with her.
He was. And they always said you could always tell when John Henry wasn't feeling good because he was friendly. He wanted babies. When he was feeling himself, he was mean. But when he wasn't feeling good, you could always tell. Yes.
When did the tradition, you know, we associate the Derby now with women wearing these elegant hats? When does that?
That goes back to the first one. Uh huh. That goes back to the first. Even before that, when you would go to the races, the ladies would all dress up, and it was kind of an English tradition to begin with, and then it became a Southern tradition. But it goes all the way back to the first Derby, the big Derby hats.
Do you have collections of hats?
We do. Yeah. There's a big display, and it changes every year. People from the community have really gotten into it, and they have a contest. And we have hundreds of hats submitted, and then we pick like 20 or 30 of them. And then after a year goes by, we give them back. And silly hats are becoming popular now, too, where people have just all kinds of crazy stuff on them. At least they're wearing clothes now. In the 70s in the infield, they weren't even wearing clothes, so that's good. If anyone's interested, I have a couple of brochures. One's for the museum, and then one is for my outreach program that I do. And if we do have any teachers in here, my program where I go talk to kids, it is absolutely free. Yeah, yeah.
Well, on behalf of WK Library, it's been our real pleasure to have you up tonight, Mr. Dreisand, and a little token of appreciation for our Kentucky Museum. It's a big bag, but not such a big gift.
Excellent.
Thanks, everyone, for coming on. We'll hope you'll join us in April
when we'll be having a special program on Appalachian cooking from Mark Stone from Pikeville College. And again, have a good evening and watch out for the snow tomorrow. Thanks.
Thank you guys for coming. I really appreciate it.